I'm gonna turn off the turn off your video.
Oh, okay. I've enjoyed seeing you.
I've enjoyed
Farewell.
seeing you. Okay.
And then let me turn off mine. Yeah,
Yes.
there we go. Okay, that'll be better for the internet.
Back to the void. We're recording, by the way, now.
It's time for recording a song.
I'm live from the Blake Hotel in Chicago.
Is the Blake Hotel swanky?
Not really, no. I think it's trying to be, but it does it leaves something to be desired.
I love hotel life. I get very philosophical about being alive in a hotel.
Oh, fantastic. My throat just gets really dry. That's pretty much all that happens to me.
Those are
I'm
similar
feeling a
experiences.
little phlegmy today, but that's probably because my brother, who's sharing a room with me, set the AC down to like 62 inadvertently last night. So,
Oh, that's our default.
oh yeah, I can't handle that.
Yeah, we sleep in the tundra.
That's fair. Fair.
I know that some people out there have some real strong feelings on AC. But there's only so many things I can be forward-thinking and progressive about.
And you've just
And
chosen that AC is not going to be one of them.
no, it's like a mental health thing for me. Like if I'm, and same thing with Nick, like if we're really hot, it we get weird. And it's not, I'm not ready to work through it yet. Like I'm sure I could and normalize like being hot and like sit
No.
with that discomfort until it felt like normalcy. I am sure that that is within the realm of possibility in this lifetime, but I just can't do that and all the other shit too
Sure,
that I'm
sure.
trying to like become a decent human being about.
That's
But don't worry, I feel tons of guilt about AC use.
That's fair. Hey, I mean, it's a necessity sometimes, but I hate being in it all day. Like I am someone who will like give it like turn it on and like blast it for a moment of relief and then immediately turn it off because I'm over it. That's kind of my approach. Because
Yeah, I
I
think
too
that's
share the
smart.
like pitta, like when it's above a certain, I don't know if it's when it's above a certain temperature or when it's the temperature plus like above 60% humidity is when I just lose my shit. I like can't function as a human anymore.
Yeah, I feel you on that. I know that hormonally, like I've got some thyroid shit that I'm still working out, but I know that all of a sudden my thermostat is wildly different. Like I get cold all the time now,
Your
and
internal thermostat.
yeah, my
Okay.
internal thermostat is fucked.
Because at
So
first I
I'm,
was like, you should probably get that fixed.
you're like,
Like,
that's
as
an
it was
easy
like.
solution. So I'm all weird, but and Nick and I used to have the exact same temperature, and we would, but now, like when the AC's on, sometimes I get cold, so we have to turn it off. But mostly it's about sleep. Like, I
Yeah.
need, like, I, during the day, whatever, I can deal with it. But nighttime, sleep time, I need, like, a dark, freezing cold ice box to hibernate in. Yeah, I guess that makes me,
A
a
something.
princess, a high needs. I don't know. Ryan, there's a lot to talk
There's
about.
a lot to talk about.
The first is I can't, I mean I'm giddy. I'm like a little excited about what's happening politically. I feel like a cloud is beginning to crack
Now that
and
you've said that, it
lift.
will cease to crack. It will cover
Oh, for
itself
fuck's
over.
sake, you're right. Damn it.
It's possible. It is possible. It's just so hard to, like, it's like every hour it's a new fucking shitstorm. And hopefully this all leads to something. Something.
I just, it's at least about to get more entertaining.
Sure.
I don't know.
Don't know if
So there's
entertaining
that.
is the right word, but
you know, I have to not think of it as entertaining, but I think that's how I do that so that it's more distant.
Sure.
But the other thing is, and I think that this is related, and we should begin topically in this way, phase three of Project Sunshine. Can we start there?
Sure. With the caveat that there is quite a bit of, well, let's say that the phase three report came out, and then immediately there was an email that was sent out from Shambhala saying, what was the title of the email? It was, oh wow, I should really have all of this pulled up already. You ambushed me, Kate. Response to recent allegations of misconduct. And then that they categorically deny the substance of the allegations, which are not only unfounded, but are each based on speculative and unsubstantiated claims. The publication of such salacious and defamatory information is grossly irresponsible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I will link various things in the show notes, but there were a couple things that came out in the new report, some of which were just more stories about just the relationships that the Sack Gang has had with various women over the years, some of which are described as by the people writing the stories described as consensual. It was just sort of what happened afterwards that was a little bit confusing. You just sort of this habit of kind of what seems to be sort of people in the community like procuring women for him to relate to in various platonic and not platonic ways, potentially abusive ways. And, you know, it just really, the whole thing just makes me want to, like, step even further away than I had previously stepped, if that's at all possible. You know, I feel like this is just the... This is also still very much the tip of the iceberg, you know? Like, the fact that there is even a phase three to publish means that, like, it doesn't fucking stop here, you know? There's more to be said. You can absolutely... I'll link the PDF article in the show notes. But as always with these things, like, take care before you read it. Like, I read it this morning, like, all the way through, I stupidly did that before I had the time set aside that I was going to practice, and no practice was really possible. Just sort of, like, felt a little sick to my stomach and decided to just take a long shower and get coffee. So, you know, there are a lot of people that in the community that are talked about in it, including one story of a woman who was raped by a center director and brought the story directly to Pema Chodron, allegedly just said that wasn't true and that she didn't believe this woman. And the woman who was recounting this story wrote in because Pema Chodron was named as a member of the quote-unquote transition team. So she was questioning whether that is actually skillful to have someone who has a history of silencing even one human to be part of the transition team that would try and figure out what to do with this mess. So you know, it's definitely worth a read if you're interested. If you just even if you're just resigned to be like, oh, that Shambhala shit, like, fuck that, I don't need to be involved or hear about that. I feel like whenever these things happen, especially those of us that are involved in, you know, spiritual communities of any shape, size, form, it's actually really good to, when you have the capacity, read these accounts and read how each community deals with this sort of these allegations and these crimes, and the interplay between the sort of how do I say this? The organizational quality, or not quality, the organization that is supposedly supporting the teachings, and then the things of value that you actually got from whatever you learned in that community. And I feel like also people who are Catholic are going through a very similar exploration with that report from Pennsylvania. So it seems, you know, timely to at least be informed about what's going on, even if, you know, as I do, I don't want to get emotionally or politically embroiled within this organization that I have a, you know, some history with.
You know, just it, or if I boil it down, everything is garbage.
Yes.
I don't know. I really feel like this is a really interesting time to be alive, in the sense that everything is, again, you know, it's almost like it's the 60s and 70s again.
Yeah.
Like, God is dead. Everybody's suspect. And there's great freedom in that. There's a lot of opportunities for very challenging and difficult emotions. And my gut reflex often is abnegation and stepping away and withdrawing from critical engagement sometimes. Like when it's...
Yeah, yeah.
When the volume or the pitch starts to resonate at a higher frequency, sometimes the most valuable thing is to step back and observe and wait. But I also think there's great creative potential when institutions that have long been sucking the oxygen out of a room start to crumble.
Sure. Yeah.
Like what will we create that will, replace the needs of whatever an institution or even a methodology or a guru or a human yeah. or an idea, what comes and takes its place?
Yeah. And, you know, there was a, as part of this, a sort of a statement that sort of made me kind of the most disappointed, which other people may have read as just a kind of like may not have registered with folks reading it, but this registered because it comes from the woman who I took refuge with. The woman who actually like led the ceremony to take refuge, which if you know, I think I talk about that in an episode like far, far back. But basically, it's the vow you take to become a Buddhist. Like, not it is not like school or lineage sort of dependent. It's pretty much the same thing across Buddhism. And I think this is an interesting and the statement that is included here is an interesting and problematic statement, potentially, is that human mistakes have to be included or there is no path. Acknowledging our mistakes is key to this. This is true for both teachers and ourselves. Shambhala doesn't exist without lineage. If we take away the Sakyong or the Sakyong and the Vidyadhara's photos, we are removing the Shambhala lineage. The Sakyong is taking time away from teaching and administration to do a very challenging personal work. He has already started that work. At the same time, he is still the Sakyong, the Shambhala lineage holder. Shambhala doesn't exist without lineage.
Ugh.
And like, there are so many aspects of truth in that. But then it gets all mucked up in this language about lineage. It's true. Shambhala doesn't exist without the folks who influence our understanding of Shambhala. Like, as in there wouldn't be a thing that we call Shambhala if, you know, these two men and the community around them hadn't existed. But statements like that just really disappoint me.
Right?
It just really disappoints, because it's so, whether it means to be or not, so insensitive. And so, corrosive to what is actually being advocated for by Buddhism more broadly. Like, there's the old Zen saying that if you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha.
Really?
Yes.
Meaning?
Yeah, it's if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Basically, it's a snarky, I interpret it as a snarky version of form is emptiness, emptiness is form, which is from the Heart Sutra, which is sort of the heart of all of the Mahayana teachings, which is basically the Buddha sitting in front of a group of students. He's not actually saying this, he's meditating, and his student is recounting this, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, so on and so on and so on, basically saying that, you know, all of this talk of attachment, if you just end up getting attached to the form, then you've missed the point altogether. So there is no, all of these lists, all of these concepts that have been studied, they're completely empty. And so very much in the way that Buddhism in many ways was a response to the sort of Brahmanistic culture that was present in India at that time, supposedly, he like did it to himself. He was like, yeah, there's all these things. There's the five skandhas, there's the four noble truths, there's the eightfold path, but all of it is empty. It was why when I watched I think it's the most recent Star Wars movie, and have you seen this?
Yeah.
Where there's a scene where between Yoda and Luke Skywalker, where Yoda like burns the tree down and is like laughing.
Yeah.
That's the Heart Sutra. Like that's exactly what I was like cracking up in the theater. No one else was, because it's like, wow, you're not even gonna, this is just like Buddhism. Like, you're not even going to like couch it in some vague like Eastern ambiguous form. It's just saying like, yes, there are these books of the Jedi, there is this form, but like we can burn it all to the ground and it doesn't matter because it's describing something that's inherent. So I think when we have statements like there is no Shambhala without the lineage, first of all, what the fuck is a lineage?
Burn it.
And are you considering the lineage just those two men? Are you considering it the lineages that go back thousands upon thousands of years in Tibet? Like, where are you drawing that line? And if it really is so special, burn that shit to the ground.
Yep.
The organization is not the lineage. The shrine room is not the lineage. The pictures on the wall are not the lineage. And if the lineage is done as, that much harm, then it might be worth packing in the lineage in the first place.
Also, there's just such a profound insecurity in the maintenance of lineage in that way. Like I think about the Catholic Church in this, and I, in my family, there's a lot of practicing Catholics, and I have conversations with them, and so for me, I try to think, okay, well, what, as if my opinion mattered, what is a path forward for the Catholic Church? Like what might it look like to move forward? And my thought is always, all right, so we get rid of how we think about priesthood, and women could become priests, married people could become priests, anybody could become priests if they're called, like if whoever, it doesn't matter. But to just limit it to, the vow of chastity for me is, I think, part of the issue. And then I get into the thing about Catholicism. I think that is interesting is there really is a very rich and intellectual history in the Catholic Church. Like when you look at there's a couple of schools of priesthood that are particularly academic, and the way they adhere and interpret the text is different. And I do think it'll be interesting to see if the Vatican ever changes, if there's or if it's just going, and I think what might be interesting is looking at some point, my homework assignment will be to look at church numbers, because in some areas of the world it continues to increase, and in other areas there is just a rapid leaving of the church, So like the demographics are changing, and who's coming is interesting, and but the absolute gripping to this idea that this is what the priesthood has to be in order for it to follow the quote unquote lineage all the way back to the Septuagint and all the way, is like, it feels so meaningless and so far away from what it could be and what it might truly be if we looked at the text. At the end of the day, Ryan, I won't bore our listeners anymore with talk of Catholicism, but my takeaway for a lot of this is words matter, and how we interpret texts matters a lot. And so, in the absence of critical engagement with written materials of antiquity, we rely on leaning on humans and the lineage through them. And not that I think we should construct our entire belief system solely around textuality, but I think that when, as language evolves, as our understanding of language evolves, as we become more sophisticated readers of what was written, you know, and understanding that grammar was different and our interpretation of like the passive tense changes.
And culture was different.
Yes. We might start to say, whoa, 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 what they actually meant by this was metaphor, or what they actually meant by this was literal. And maybe we don't know. And maybe
if it was literal, is it just an expression of either that culture and aspects of that culture that maybe are not applicable to our culture today? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's
are
a
we
lot
expecting
of that.
Them to be yeah. prescient? Were we yeah, expecting yeah. the people who were writing back then to understand that this is how the world would look? Because I don't see anywhere in that text where it said man and the creator of these texts is going to understand and be able to read the future.
Yeah.
Although I could be wrong on that. There actually could be things that are like, this was a saint who was able to see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I think people are, I think there is a fear of reinterpretation.
Yeah.
Because it somehow erodes a foundation. And by eroding a foundation, you're saying you've wasted your time. And people are terrified of that, of like, maybe what you invested yourself in was, you know, a lifetime of belief in was wrong. Yeah. And they're scared of that.
But there's, you know, there's also a, like, we don't really know how to debate anymore, because debate quickly, like, goes to debating the merits of someone's own character as opposed to the actual, like, topic at hand. You know, do you know what I mean by that?
100%. Ryan, you... I'm reading this book right now that basically says what you just said, that I have to let everybody know about for a second. It's called Flunking Democracy.
Oh, interesting.
And it's by Michael Rebell. I might be pronouncing that wrong. R-E-B-E-L-L.
Okay.
And this whole book is about schools, courts, and civic participation. And it's about... I'll probably butcher a summary, but in short, it's that for a democracy to work, we have to educate the citizens so that the citizens can meaningfully participate in the democratic process. So if people can't debate, if people can't comprehend, if people can't engage, then the democracy goes away.
Mm-hmm.
It gets turned over to demagogues. And this book is saying that it is the responsibility of the courts to ensure that everyone has an equal and adequate education so that they can preserve democracy.
Yeah.
And I think it's freaking fascinating because it's exactly what you said. People aren't comfortable debating. And I wonder if we have extracted the skill set needed to have a meaningful debate from our school systems, both public and private, so that it's not just like, this is uncomfortable to do. It's just like a muscle that is atrophied culturally.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's, I mean, you see it not only, it's not even really just a, like a left versus right political thing. It's even, you know, you actually see it on the left all the time, like just between folks who really agree on like 99% of what they're talking about. Then they get to like one thing and it's like, you're a shitty person because you like, you know, and it's just like, oh, okay, no. Maybe we could like step back and actually look at what, like, where we came to these conclusions, and yeah. So I don't know. It's just a very interesting time, and I think. I don't know. I think in terms of I don't know. I had a thought and then it went away. So I'm just going to leave it with I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I do think that I'm excited that you connected two ideas for me in my head that had been sitting right next to each other but didn't know they were.
Oh,
You know, like everything that's happening right now, both politically and in the yoga world, is super related, you know.
Yeah.
I and how we which oh my God, ties to the other topic I wanted to touch on today too. A little bit, which is you know, how we the construct of childhood and how we think about kids. It's a obviously it's a much larger topic. I'm not gonna go ass deep, but obviously I, for selfish reasons, you know, have been thinking a lot about education. And part of the reason I'm reading this book is because my dad had a case he was involved in the 90s in Rhode Island, Supreme Court, about funding for public schools and how if you live in a rich community that pays a lot of property taxes, their school systems get a shitload of money. And if you happen to live in a neighborhood that doesn't pay a lot of money in property taxes, your school systems get nothing, which leaves us with a public school system that is wildly different. There are schools that have textbooks that say one day man will walk on the moon, while you have another school where every kid has a freaking iPad, which is neither equal nor adequate. And, you know, it's an interesting case that's come up in many states, but you know, sitting on the very beginning base camp of parenting and looking at how we think about kids and educating them, it's just we live in a weird culture. Like I spent, you know, the first 30 years of my life or some shit never thinking about it ever, you know? And so much of my life right now has been a slap in my own face of why weren't you thinking about this? Why didn't you care about this? You know, even if I didn't have a kid, I should have been thinking about it just for cultural reasons, like just for a, like, well, even if I don't have one, like it's just such a interesting philosophical thing to be engaged with is how we fucking educate people, because how we educate them and how we equip people to think, you know, starts really freaking early in the public schools. And oh, I'm gonna get set on fire for this one, but you know, when I tell me if this is your experience. So the people I went to college with, and I went to a couple different colleges before I settled on one that I could be mediocre at. And in all of them, my experience was people that went to school for education. A lot of them, it felt like I just know I'm going to be a teacher because I want summers off.
Now, I went to performing arts schools, so I don't really have anything to like compare.
But did you have buddies that you went to high school with, that you stayed friends with?
All of the people in high school that I knew that and through college that I knew that became teachers all became various forms of music or arts teachers, which I think is a slightly different
Totally.
motivation, even if it does also involve summers off. It's like summers off so I can go like do creative projects that I want to do. You know what I like? It's just a it's a different I think it's a different motivation. But go ahead.
You're like, no, go on.
Go
Continue to put
on.
your foot directly in your mouth. I'm going to step back and not be so anecdotal. And instead, I'm going to be more abstract and useless.
What a
I
surprise. Abstract and useless. That's the other that's our
That's our
other
subtitle.
band. That's our second band.
Abstract, useless.
That's
It is.
what was our first band called?
Pitchy and average.
Pitchy and Average. Oh, we got to get a reunion back together soon.
Ryan, just so in Germany,
Okay.
public educators get paid a shitload. They get paid on average as much as like doctors and lawyers do. And they're expected to have the equivalent of a PhD in education.
Yeah.
Should we do everything Germany does? Certainly not.
Certainly not.
But there is a, you know, we devalue public school teachers and the people who, there are many brilliant, talented, passionate, gifted teachers out there. They exist. And there are many teachers that are like, this is a career that pays what it pays. And if you get so many years in, you get a pension and you get summers off and it's hard work, but it doesn't always inherently draw the best and the brightest in the way it would to say, go to medical school.
Sure.
It is not as challenging in some ways to be a part of. And I think that there's good, there's a good and bad side to that. Obviously, you know, like I don't think everything has to be like super difficult to be valuable. But how did we get on the rabbit hole of education? This is,
I don't know. That was all you.
Yeah. Yeah. So long story short, I think a lot of, I've been thinking a lot about like public school education and teaching yoga and equipping people specifically. We don't do much to equip people to teach and to teach really well. And then we put all these rules on them that the kids have to pass all these tests. Yeah. And the result of which is a population that doesn't know how to have a conversation that's persuasive or a conversation that is constructively critical. And we shut people down for having opinions and we all go to our corner.
Yep.
And we do that in the yoga community. It's terrifying to don't frickin' debate. And we do that in our politics. And I sometimes show up in the classroom and wonder if it matters. And I know it does to just show up and keep doing what we're doing. But you know, I read the Jay Brown article about like, if you're teaching anything other than what you're practicing, you're a fraud, which, you know, is stuff you and I have been saying forever. His article about it is worth the read. I don't necessarily agree with everything in it because what we would end up with is perhaps what we might end up with is a series of yoga classes wherein everybody is rolling around doing three shapes and done. And that's beautiful. But is that the only way to have an authentic?
Yeah, I think right? I think there's a difference between in the article, one of the poll quotes is nothing turns a yoga teacher into a fraud faster than continuing to teach something that has ceased to be useful to them in their own life. Now, I would agree with that to a point, but that's not to say that I wouldn't teach someone something that was at one point useful, that I still deemed to be useful in that circumstance, to help someone or a class of people learn something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there are things that I don't necessarily practice every day, or that I rarely practice. It used to be a sort of everyday part of my practice, but it doesn't mean that I should never teach that ever again. It just means that if I do teach that again, it's going to be in really like specific circumstances. But you know, I think probably what I think a lot of what there's a difference between talking about the content that someone's teaching in front of the room, which should go through some editing process from their own practice.
Well, it has to.
It has to. I'm going to try to organize this thought. So.
Why? I never do.
So, yeah, so there has to be some sort of editing process from teaching to, or from practice to teaching. That's inherent. And the... authenticity comes from someone's own understanding of their practice and their ability to communicate that to other folks. And so it has much more to do with view and intention than it does with what yoga poses are being taught.
Huh.
I don't know if I believe that 100%, but it was the thought that came out.
Yeah, I agree.
Because sometimes this gets mixed up with a conversation that a lot of newer teachers like to have about, like, well, what if you can't do a pose? Can you still teach that pose? And this is not what we're talking about. Or at least this is not what I'm talking about. Sure, if you're teaching people to put their foot behind your head, but every time you demo foot behind the head, you get a searing pain up your lower back. Yeah, fucking don't do that. Like, come on. And examine what was valuable about that in the first place that you think should be, that it should be communicated to a room full of folks, most of whom you probably don't necessarily know very well. But that's not to say, even though I don't, you know, I don't teach, or I don't practice sun salutations that much. That doesn't mean that I don't see a value in teaching them. Even if the intention behind teaching them is just to give a group of folks something familiar to latch onto before I ask them to roll around on the floor and do something silly. Like, so it has much more to do with view and intention. Than it does to, you know, if your view of yoga on your own mat is one in which you're using breathing and moving exercises and meditation exercises in order to relieve suffering, and then you go into a classroom and all of a sudden your intention is to give people some intensity that you perceive that they're expecting, that's going to throw a glitch in the wheel. Might be a small glitch, but you'll have to negotiate those two things within yourself, if not to the group of students.
So if we're truly talking about teaching too, like, sometimes we teach things that we don't love or value or practice because it's still important to know they exist. Like, for example, if, and this is the difference between teaching and experience and teaching, you know, offering experience versus educating, right?
Sure. So, yeah. Yeah.
If we extend that analogy to, like, I go in and I teach a class on literature, wouldn't it be fucked if all I ever taught was literature that I was in love with, or that reread and read and reread, and I, like, avoided the literature I didn't value? Wouldn't that be withholding?
Yeah.
That'd be, I don't know. That might be a shitty argument. I don't know. I teach things that are not of value to me in the day or in that month or in that season. And we've talked about this before. So, like, I worry about calling out fraudulence in this way. Well, also, I know what he means. There's people that are like,
absolutely, I know what he means. But I think the other thing too is that oftentimes, like, I think about the Monday, Wednesday classes that I used to teach at Back Bay. Like, there were things that I would teach in those classes, not because I necessarily found them all that valuable in my own class, but because I knew that people were going to be exposed to certain shapes and ideas and techniques in other people's classes at the studio. So I found it sort of part of my responsibility to, you know, not every class, but some classes, like, teach some things that, you know, okay, this is, you know, not something that I necessarily practice, but I know it's really common in other classes, so let's look at how we can troubleshoot this, you know, and how we can explore it in a way that's a little less clunky, perhaps, than you might be doing in a faster-paced
You were also doing interesting prophylactic things.
Yes, yes. Yes. I don't know that I would call them that, but I...
But I would.
Sure. So yeah, it's the conversation of authenticity is not one... or fraudulence in that manner. Like, I mean, this is a conversation that is well beyond any one blog on the subject. You know, especially when I think about, I think I still have like two more calls left on that Yoga Alliance working group that I talked about a few episodes ago. And what I keep coming back to as I like ponder that whole process, you know, apart from the fact that who knows what's going to happen to the recommendations that come out of those groups, but that's another story. But I struggle with there being this quote-unquote industry that does require some form of professional training, and then also it's yoga, and I see the training getting in the way of the yoga. So I fundamentally don't care if someone teaches unless what they really want is to teach. And if, and either way, my main care when I'm working with a student in the context of a more concentrated period of time or a more individuated period of time, by that I mean working with them one-on-one, is that they actually understand how to practice well. Because I also think that that's far more valuable than professional training. Because at that point, like, this is how I think of it, honestly. Like, if the focus was on practicing well, which is not to say getting all the poses, right? It, just understanding how the body moves, how your body moves, how, you know, there is a relationship between layers and parts of the body, how there is a relationship between the physical body, the emotional fields, the intellectual mind, you know, if you want to consider spirit as part of that, you're certainly welcome to. But like, to have an inquiry into that and have that inquiry be so well rooted that quote unquote professional training is really just professional training. It's, this is how you use your voice. These are some concerns about language that we should cover. These are some concerns about inclusivity that we should cover. This is a basic understanding of what trauma is, not how to address trauma, but this is what trauma is. This is, you know, to basically just as you would have taught someone the variables that exist within their own body and how to use them through the context of moving and breathing exercises, then you're just understanding the more complex variables that exist when you're looking at other people. And the work of what is triangle pose has already been done. So professional training just gets to be fucking professional training. But that's a pretty radical departure from what we have now. And to be honest, who knows whether that would work better? I don't know that that would work better. I just have a hunch that it would.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that one. I had good readers tend to make good writers. Not everyone that's a good reader is a good writer, yeah. But you gotta.
There's a tendency, you know. Yeah.
Good. So it's the same thing with teaching yoga. Like good practitioners, somebody that has a personal and I want to say intimate. That's not quite right. But somebody who has a personal
intimate is right. I think that's right.
All right, we'll go with it.
Not necessarily meaning it, like you can have an intimate experience of yoga in the context of a group, I think.
Yes. Somebody who has that relationship with yoga, I believe, has the foundation to be a good teacher. But somebody that doesn't have a relationship with their own private understanding of the practice, it's next to impossible. So if we're spending all of our energy teaching people to teach, but not teaching them how to have their own experience of the practice and reminding them that that is above all priority one, then it's,
yeah,
then we're screwed.
Yeah.
Ryan, I feel like it's a good time to pivot to the occult. And sure. speaking of the intimacies of practice. So you sent me a beautiful post. I kind of want you to describe it because it's your treasure that you found.
What post are we talking about? I know. I know.
Tell us about your find of the week.
So there is an interesting company afoot called Chakrubs. Chakrubs. And they
Chakrubs?
Chakrubs. Like
Chakrubs.
Yes. They are, as their website says, the original crystal sex toy company. So they make sex toys out of crystals, and this was not the first post I saw on this, but it was the most sort of explicit post. Some yoga teacher had posted a picture of a what appeared to be jade butt plug on their Instagram, and then had a long explanation about his Muladhara practice. And I was just like, "Oh wow, we've really crossed into some new territory now, haven't we?" And I struggle because it's like, I am all for people experiencing whatever pleasure they want to experience, but it's more the I don't know how I feel about the juxtaposition of that with chakra practice, or like, I don't know. Like I see the connection. I see how you could have an experience like that. But like, I don't know where my, like, is it a feeling of like, this is a weird, like, cultural appropriation thing? or maybe that's not the right word, but it's just a weird juxtaposition, or is that just some like latent prudishness and like we should all be posting pictures of our sex toys and talking about them? Like, I don't know which, I can see both sides of the coin.
I know. That was my response too. Like, my first thing is like, hysterical. And then my second thing was, no, that's fine. That's great. Like, why? Yeah. My issue with it is this conflation of, I'm making this about chakra healing and yoga and I'm selling it.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it is just the capitalism that is, rubbing me the wrong way. That's a bad pun.
I know. So here's the thing.
I couldn't even stop myself.
Had the post been multiple butt plugs and like a discussion about like, hey, this is something I do and I have found it useful in my quest for healing.
Yeah.
And this one in particular is interesting to me because of XYZ. That would have felt like more of a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, but because it was like, no, this one.
Yeah. This one. I also don't know that, like, I'm not sold on the efficacy of it being crystal.
Yeah, what is about like, yogis and crystals?
Yeah, I don't really know. like silicone and stainless steel, those work just fine. that's my main question is like, I don't know, maybe it's infinitely more healthy for you to use a crystal than those other materials. Who knows? I'm ignorant in that regard. But it did walk this fine line of like, oh wow, we have a really hard time in the yoga community talking about sex. For good reason, because there have been people who have been, you know, through yoga, you know, there have been teachers who have viewed yoga as a avenue to sexually abuse people, as we've heard time and time and time and time again. So, you know, the sensitivity is necessary, but, you know, there was part of me that was like, well, this is someone advertising a product that he's, you know, using on himself. And so, you know, I see no problem with it. It was just the like capitalism. Like if we, and also to like, it was sort of, maybe it wasn't as like veiled as I thought it was, but I read it as very like, well, why don't you just talk about orgasm instead of talking about Muladhara? Like, why don't you just talk, like, you can use both things simultaneously, you know, like, but if you just lean into the yoga language, it feels a little icky, like, talk about sex then.
Yep, 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 yep. Agreed. And, you know, the other thing is,
ooh, when we start to eggs.
Yeah. When we start talking about crystals, I think it's interesting because there is a large overlap of people that are interested in crystal healing and astrology and herbalism and oftentimes like essential oils, and like there's all of the, and I'm not casting shade on any of them at all, just noting the overlap of interest.
Yeah.
And that's always what piques my interest is like, oh, look, it's another yoga teacher that is drawn to this, which makes yoga teachers that are not drawn to those things super interesting to me.
Yeah.
Sounds shitty. I don't mean it in a shitty way. I just mean like,
but you know, I have less and less, Like, I actually have no problems with people being, like using astrology. There's actually a great explainer on Netflix from Vox about astrology and sort of how it came to be and why it seems to pervade despite science, you know, begging to differ. And it's definitely worth watching. And now I lost my train of thought. But I look at it very much the same way that I look at this conversation around chakra. They are, in my understanding, places to rest your mind and meditate. They're just places to hold focus. And in that regard, they can be super helpful. But everything else that's been laid on top of them, my understanding is that's entirely Jungian. And so if you want to use all that, so that's great. It's just you got to be like transparent about that. But it is interesting as an exercise to, in a meditative way, ask yourself a question and quote unquote listen with your mind fixed in different parts of your body that you associate with chakra. Not because it's going to unlock anything or like your kundalini is going to magically unlock and everything's going to be great, or you'll have a psychotic breakdown depending on which how you think of that stuff. But it's just interesting to see what arises. And so that's great. So if astrology gives people an interesting framework for which to focus their life and understand their life, then that's fantastic. I just think it gets a little tricky when that's not explicit. That like this is just a framework. Frameworks are good. We inherently like to make meaning out of things. That's sort of part of our human condition. But it's just a framework. It's not, it's a map. It's not the actual thing. So as long as that is held out in the open, if someone wants to pay for an astrology reading or pay to get their chart done, then I'm totally fine with the capitalistic aspects of that. But sometimes people are less than clear about what's actually going on with various forms like that. And also the people that I know that have a real like personal connection specifically to astrology or various forms of like paganism, they're actually kind of like it's very personal. They're actually quite private about it. Not in the fact that they like hide it from folks, but it's just it, like they don't actually talk about it all that much. And I perceive their connection to it to be, you know, the same as my connection to yoga. And so, you know, I think I've softened a little bit around those more occult aspects. But I think it gets really blurry when people try to like yoga and crystal healing with extra Reiki, and like it's, you know, that stuff gets to be a little over the top.
Yeah, in many cases, it appears to be a mile wide and an inch deep.
Yeah.
Because I'll get real into it if I know that person is real into it and they've been
Yeah.
doing it for like a while and they went a mile deep and an
Yeah.
inch wide on something sort of
Yeah.
esoteric. I'm totally a champion of that. It's just the whole like, I took a workshop on this and now I'm going to teach a workshop on this that I get
Yes.
like, fuck you.
Yes. I am so fascinated by this website. I will put it in the show notes, everybody. Have a good time. Have a good time. Did I lose you, Kate?
No, can you hear me?
Yes, you're back. Fantastic.
Oh, praise. Praise.
Did you say praise? Praise be, everybody. May the Lord open. Okay, we should end it there. Oh, Kate, you're gone again.
This has been Unrolled.
Yes, it has. Live from the Blake Hotel.
And from the corner of...
Oh, and you're gone again.
All right, you do the closing, because every time I try to do it, it breaks.
Okay, okay. You can find us at unrolledpodcast.com, unrolledpodcast on Instagram. Thank you so much to those of you who donate on Patreon. It is very, very helpful. I think that's it. You can always email us, unrolledpodcast@gmail.com. We love to hear from you with questions, concerns, all that jazz. So have a wonderful day, evening, whatever time it is that you're listening to this. And we'll talk to y'all soon.
Bye.
Bye.